Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
If you call me an extremist, you haven't got any words really left for fire-breathing people who think that transgender people are kind of an abomination unto God and, you know, they should be wiped out of existence. You need to be really careful, you know, that you're marking people out of 10 and you don't use up all of your fire and brimstone on someone like J.K. Rowling, who, you know, sends some pretty spicy tweets, but in terms of her actual policy prescription that she believes in, it's pretty squarely in the middle of the consensus in both Britain and Australia.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
The Atlantic columnist and BBC podcaster Helen Lewis is possibly one of my favourite journalists in the world. Now, it's a big call, but there are few bylines that light me up as much when they pop up in my alerts. Helen has been a guest here before on Wild, and we actually met in London when I was launching my book at the end of last year, that's This One Wild and Precious Life. Now, in that previous episode on Wild, Helen and I talked about the new wellness grifters and gurus, the time she interviewed Jordan Peterson for GQ magazine and what she learned from that, and what the hell happened to Russell Brand. I highly recommend that you go back and listen to that episode because I feel that it's probably as relevant as ever. Now, since then, in her Atlantic column, she's covered all kinds of nuanced topics, including the subtleties of the schism occurring in the body positive communities over the Ozempic drug, the divide among Taylor Swift fans over her boyfriend's intelligence, specifically the way he likes to spell squirrel, and most recently, the phenomenon of Kate Middleton truthers. Helen's also a regular roving guest on various heterodox podcasts in the US and beyond, including Blocked and Reported and Decoding the Gurus, two of my favourite pop cultural sort of shredding podcasts. And of course, I've had one of the hosts of Decoding the Gurus here on Wild as well. I'll put that episode in the show notes. Now, I thought I'd ask Helen back on today to discuss a few very, very online trends and vortexes, worlds within worlds, that I feel many of us that are outside of this very online world and overly informed heterodox community might not be on top of or might be so bamboozled by that we just kind of can't fathom it. But they're all very important for fathoming what the hell is going on in the world today. Specifically, I want to talk to Helen about the rise of TERFs, which stands for Trans-Exclusionary Radical Feminism, and the subtleties that we can explore within the phenomenon, like how it has seen the what is a woman question surface once again, and has seen feminists join forces, weirdly, with the religious right and then get co-opted by the bro podcasters and the pronatalists and, well, Tucker Carlson. Interestingly, TERFs is a very British phenomenon, as are the more considered debates around whether trans rights can infringe on the safety and rights of women and the feminist cause. They're very, very complex topics to explore. The co-opting of these voices and conversations, however, happens in the US by far-right men's groups who weaponize the arguments against the left and against other feminists. Helen and I also talk about how the left failed what she calls the Hamas test on October 7. We cover the glorification of men who identify as being on the spectrum as geniuses and why male geniuses have always reflected or dictated the values of the times. But mostly, this is a conversation about navigating complexity and trying to answer the question, what the hell is going on in the world today? I hope you enjoy this chat with Helen Lewis as much as I always enjoy a chat with Helen Lewis. I'll see you at the end for a bit of a wrap-up of this conversation, as I tend to do at the end of these podcasts. Helen Lewis, thanks once again for joining us all here on Wild. It's really great to have you back, and you do come up in conversation a bit because some of the guests that I interview tend to have some kind of nexus with you. You are everywhere.
I spend a fully, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day on WhatsApp. I mean, it's partly source cultivation. It's partly that I'm a massive gossip. But in journalism, I think luckily those two things overlap quite heavily. So yeah, I spend a lot of time talking to people.
You're also very, very online. And so you're sort of at the front line of most things that are going on. You've got to sort of, you dip your toes into these places. Sometimes you get cancelled and sent away. But yes, you emerge with something that can be shared with the rest of us. So thank you for going to the dark depths of everything that's going on online.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure blue sky is that bad, but yes, I think my most recent experience of just kind of looking at an online space and thinking, wow, this is a strong taste. It was Blue Sky, which is a kind of in smaller version of Twitter, basically. But the golden thread through all of my career is psychology. I'm just really fascinated by how people work and how they think, and particularly when they're completely different to me. And I just kind of want to wrap my head around that. So the internet is, you know, all human life is there. So I spend a lot of time peering into its dark corners.
What happened on Blue Sky? I mean, I don't think many people, as you say, are on Blue Sky. But yeah, what's going on over there? How is it different to Twitter?
I would say that the kind of people who've taken refuge from Twitter and Blue Sky are some of the more kind of progressive people. And I think they felt, not unreasonably, that Twitter under Elon Musk, or X as it now is, you know, has become a bit of a kind of a bear pit, I guess, now that anybody can buy a blue tick and that elevates their replies. You do see a lot of pretty rancid stuff in your feed, and they kind of have therefore taken refuge. Now, Threads, which is owned by Meta, the company behind Facebook and Instagram, is also a kind of version of that, but it's a much more corporatized one. And they've said specifically that they don't really care about people talking about news. In fact, they sort of prefer people don't. It wants to be more of a positive space. So, you know, some people who are, I think, more on the left have defected to Threads, but some of them have gone to Blue Sky. And it has had, as spaces on the left tend to, already a kind of few schisms and huge falling outs and kind of narcissism with small differences. But yeah, it's not like any online space is free from drama. And Twitter certainly was never free from drama.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I watch it. I remember when Twitter was free from drama. It was a nice space where we all sort of shared thoughts on things, and it kind of was almost like LinkedIn in the early days, where we all just said nice things about each other's observations.
That's very sweet that you think LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn is a terrifying place.
Oh,
it's like
so
the kind of grind influencers. I think there's a thing that, so Cory Doctorow has this word, which I'm sure you've heard before, which is inshitification, which is the idea that things just sort of degrade, particularly online. You know, so anything that's nice, people will just move in and try and make money out of it, or try and over-harvest it, or try and suck it dry. And I think you've seen that with all of the big public social networks, is what started off being people creating things that were fun. You know, someone went, oh, there's some money to be made out of this. And that's kind of the snake in the Garden of Eden. As soon as you let in people with a profit motive, then, it, you know, things change and feel very different.
Yeah, I think the common denominator is the algorithms. And I think both you and I are on Substack. For anyone listening, and I'll put it in the show notes, the Blue Stocking is Helen's Substack, and it's wonderful. But they've made a commitment to not bringing in algorithms, and I think that will make a difference. There's also the paywall as well, which means that people, it's a more of a discerning, committed audience. The worst grifters in the world and trolls tend to not want to have to pay for the privilege of sharing their horrible, toxic opinions. So it does sort of, I guess, yeah, sift out some of the worst offenders.
Yeah, I mean, Substack has got some people that, you know, I personally, where I overlord of Substack, would kick off the platform, you know, vaccine deniers and people like that. But I have to say, as a as a user, and I mean as someone who subscribes to many Substacks and is the author of one, it is an undeniably much more pleasant experience. In the same way that being on the podcast with you and you know, you talking to your listeners is a much more pleasant experience, because people have to kind of, you know, there's a barrier to entry. And people don't tend to hate listen to podcasts. That's my big learning of the last couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a commitment as well to go and pull out the little bit that you're going to then go and sort of quote tweet and dredge, right? I think it makes a difference if you put a transcript up, because then people can kind of pull out the bit. But yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it? A couple of, when was it? I think it was probably maybe a month or two ago. There was some hoo-ha. Legacy Media jumped on it. They're looking for something where Substack stuffs up. And I think there was sort of a Nazi hoo-ha, a couple of Nazi Substacks hit people's radars. But
yeah, there were some very small white supremacist accounts on there, which is, you know, something that you might expect, given that Substack has explicitly said that it has a fairly lax moderation policy. You know, it's caveat emptor, buyer beware. People are expected to make their own choice about what they subscribe to. That said, I think at least one account that was brought to their attention did cross over the line into hate speech or threats of violence and got kicked off. But yeah, you saw a platformer, which was a very big tech Substack, left. Ed Zitron, who's, I think, a really good writer, he left. He went to Ghost, which has even less moderation. But their point was that, you know, the Substack recommendation engine is something that drives traffic from one bit of Substack to another, and they didn't want to be kind of a part of that. And you know what? That is completely fine. It is good, actually, that there are many now newsletter platforms that you can go to. I think one of the other big problems that the internet really suffers from is the kind of creep towards monopoly, and the fact that, you know, if you don't like a space, you can't opt out of it. You know, if you're in lots of different types of jobs, you have to be on LinkedIn. You know, if you're in any kind of marketing job, even if you hate it, that's kind of something that goes with the territory, unfortunately. And it would be better if there were more diversity of choice in all kinds of areas.
Yeah, we get handcuffed to the whole thing. But it never went anywhere, that sort of Nazi Substack thing, because the algorithms didn't dial it up. So there are a couple of angry posts. But I think collectively, between all of the Substackers that they were referring to, they only had a couple of hundred subscribers, and they weren't paid subscribers. So it kind of fizzled out because the algorithms didn't dial it up. So yeah, anyway, we've sort of all got to be brave enough to pack up and leave when things get really, really toxic. But it's hard, as you say, because some people build entire businesses and networks on these social media platforms, and we're encouraged to, entice to, you know, and then, yeah, we're stuck. Are you still on Twitter?
I am, but really just to post links to my articles and occasionally, you know, have an occasional observation about British politics or something like that, or, you know, personal news, as they say. And also, you know, there are some people that I only communicate with in there, but my enthusiasm for posting on it is at record lows, because you just think, why? I'm not being paid for this. Like, I don't need this.
Yeah. So look, I was really keen to have you on because I wanted to sort of talk, I guess, in a way, about, has the world really gone mad? I mean, you're at the front line of all of this, as I say. You're sort of interacting at the level of all the nuances, the complexities, and sort of the polarization points. And you, I kind of think of you as like the school teacher on the playground that's sent out to kind of sort out a massive spat happening between two groups of kids, and you're trying to piece apart, you know, well, he said this and then she said that, but why? And, you know, and so on. And you do that with all kinds of really, you know, hard to go there types of issues. So I'm wanting to touch on something that you talk about a lot, and it's come up recently. I think you did a Blocked and Reported chat on this just recently, and I really recommend people go and listen to that conversation, because apart from anything else, it's incredibly entertaining. You and Katie Herzog just talking a lot of jargon.
I love Katie. Happy to spend any amount of time with Katie. Yeah, it was a nice episode to do, but we did talk about the kind of British feminism wars, the kind of so-called turf,
exactly,
turf wars, the trans-exclusionary radical feminists, as they are sometimes called.
Yeah, can you actually explain what that turf war is about? And of course, the UK is referred to as Turf Island, which the Americans get a great amount of enjoyment from. But it's a really interesting division that's happening in feminism, and you're kind of very embroiled in it. I think you're, you know, the chief witch of turfdom. I think you share the stake with J.K. Rowling. And we'll get to that in a bit in terms of why you've been implicated in all of this. But explain what the turf wars are.
Well, I would say I started writing about the subject about 10 years ago as an outcrop of my writing on feminism, because it seemed to me that it had some interesting tensions with the kind of things that feminism was arguing for at the time. You know, one of which being, what does it mean to be a woman? You know, is it a purely kind of biological state? Is it about femininity? Is it about a set of assumptions that are imposed on you from outside? You know, these are all kind of quite productive and interesting questions. But also, fundamentally, in 2015, there was a parliamentary inquiry here which recommended that we should change from a system of medical gatekeeping to change your gender, legal gender, to one of purely self-identification. And that, to me, seemed quite obviously to have some big knock-on effects for women's single-sex spaces, so things like women's prisons, domestic violence shelters, that kind of thing, and also female sports because of male genetic sporting advantage. And so then the other debate that really blew up was the child transition one, the child gender debate over the use of puberty blocking drugs. So in the 2000s, a Dutch clinic developed the idea that if you took children who were gender nonconforming, this was biologically male children, the one thing that they didn't want to do, you know, if they felt that they had a trans identity, was go through male puberty. Their voices would drop, you know, they'd grow a beard, they'd become tall and broad. And actually, if you could block puberty from happening and put them straight on cross-sex hormones, on estrogen, then you would be able to have adults who could live much more easily as women.
Yes, we spoke to Hannah Barnes, who speaks to that and covered the whole Tavistock controversy. And she was on the podcast a couple of months ago. So I'll put a link to everyone who for everyone who missed that in the show notes. And you've done some work with her, of course.
Yeah, Hannah and I did an event together in Brighton, and it was which was at the start of the year, and around her book, and it was a really good example of how far the debate has moved on, actually, because I think even 2 or 3 years ago, the most grief we would have got from that event would have been from transgender activists who thought that the whole thing was a total cooked up, you know, right-wing moral panic. You know, the idea was that this was just people saying, oh my God, won't someone think of the children? And there was really no problem to be seen here. And now, thanks to the journalism of people like Hannah, there have been lots of whistleblowers working in that sector who said, actually, you know what, we did get a bit carried away. We saw kids who'd got loads of other problems, and maybe the gender dysphoria wasn't the primary one of those, or the one that we should have treated first and treated medically. And so actually, as we're talking now, only a couple of days ago, NHS England, our, you know, socialist universal healthcare service, has said it's not going to prescribe puberty blockers at all. I mean, outside of very, very, very limited circumstances, but essentially it's really said, we just don't think the evidence is there for this treatment. And that's a huge reversal. America, where I write for The Atlantic, you know, is not in that place at all. They've got a real stark division between red states, Republican states, where there are bans going through, sometimes ones that are even curbing adult ability to transition, and blue states where, you know, the idea is that they'll become sanctuaries for gender nonconforming youth, and that, you know, this is all kind of a kind of cooked up panic. So yeah, those are the three main things that I've, you know, the intersections with feminism that the trans issue has kind of brought up, and those are the three that I've most often written about, I guess, as well as the kind of meta issue, which is interesting to me as a journalist, about why are there things that you can't say, and do we get overly excited about that and these seem kind of quite glamorous, or actually are there things, you know, are people just posturing as Galileo, or are there actually things that are unsayable and should be sayable? And I think this is a case actually where it was hard to say some things that were undoubtedly true very early on in this debate, and that has, thanks to the bravery of lots of people, has become a lot easier.
Yeah. Oh, and thanks for the bravery of you as well, because you were there very early on discussing these kinds of complex issues. But just to break it down a little bit, explain to people what TERF actually stands for, because it's a branch of feminism, if you can call it that, which is quite conservative. And it's now sort of, it's almost like a term like woke, which the conservative right, but also the left, will throw around, sort of dump it onto anyone who sort of puts their hand up and says, well, hang on, this might actually be problematic for women. And there are very real issues that are still at play that still have not been solved. So explain what TERF actually stands for. And then, Helen, can you also just piece out why it is that certain branches of the feminist movement specifically have a problem with this self-identification issue?
Yeah, sure. So TERF stands for Trans-Exclusionary Radical Feminist. And to break that down for you, the idea was during the 2010s, you know, the phrase that really became paramount was trans women are women. you know, trans men are men. And then it became a non-binary people are valid because you couldn't kind of work out a way to fit that one into the framework. But for TERFs, they said, no, you know, sorry, we think woman is adult human female, and therefore trans women are men, essentially. And there's a midway position between the two of them, which is probably where I say I occupy now, which is that Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie articulated this as basically saying it's not very helpful to say much more than trans women are trans women. You know, they're both people who want to be, you know, taken as women, live as women, but there is something about the fact that they have transitioned that is also unique and important to their experience. And so perhaps we shouldn't try and narrow the category down. But the bit that isn't conservative is that, you know, they originally the TERFs were supposed to be radical feminists. Now, radical feminism is basically a branch of feminism that seeks to abolish gender. It says that it is a social construct. It's an imposition, really. You know, it's a system of behaviour that has been imposed on women in order to kind of keep them subordinate. So the idea of, you know, like you have to wear high heels to be feminine and attractive, but those are obviously harder to walk in. You know, those kind of gendered expectations of women that are imposed on them by society. And of course, that's not an accurate description of everybody who has reservations about self-idea of gender. But because it's kind of a cool, catchy word, and it's, frankly, I was just thinking about this today, it's quite easy to shout at people quite loudly from a picket line. It really seems to be the term that's kind of caught on.
Yeah, but it's interesting because there are people in the space like yourself, and I would also say J.K. Rowling to a certain extent, who are arguing from the perspective of... And I think the example that we could probably use, and this came up in the conversation that I had with Hannah Barnes, is that when somebody can self-identify, and let's take a really extreme example, because this in fact did happen in Scotland, where I think a man who'd been charged with multiple sexual assaults and murders was that he'd been charged. And then in the time before he was sentenced, he transitioned. And I think in Scotland, the law had just changed such that you could self-identify if you had identified as trans for 6 months. Now, the 6 months had transpired between being charged and then being sentenced. And so this man who claimed to have transitioned to become a woman legally had to be sent to a women's jail, where, of course, you know, women's jails generally have a lot of very traumatized women there who have often been victims of sexual assault. So I think that's probably an example where I think a lot of feminists rightly go, hang on, we've got to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, that was the case. You're talking about a guy called Adam Graham, whose female name was Isla Bryson. And basically, the prison service guidance at the time was, you know, that you should try and put prisoners in the estate to which they, you know, in which they'd feel most comfortable, unless there is some kind of compelling reason not to. But however, the what was at issue was passing this bill called the Gender Recognition Reform Bill that would have said, as you say, that after basically on, you know, just signing a sworn declaration after a certain amount of time, you know, that's it. And no one can question your gender. And you get all the kind of privileges and special exemptions that are associated with that gender. And one of the most shocking things about that is that there were a series of amendments proposed to that bill by the other parties. It was a Scottish National Party bill. And one of the amendments from another party was, you know, if this is we don't want this to apply to sex offenders. And that was rejected. That was voted down by the SNP. Because it was kind of considered to be a transphobic myth. And it was also considered to be suggesting that all trans women by default were predators, which obviously I don't think is true. And I think it's very important to formulate the problem with the argument is, right? The argument is that sex offenders are, as a class of prisoners, known to be extremely manipulative. They're different from other bits of the prison population in that respect. And therefore, they will do almost anything to gain advantages, right? They're fundamentally not honest people. You can tell that because they've been put in prison for sex offences. And also, you know, the fact is they seek access to victims. And also it's really, really tough to be a sex offender in prison. They are, you know, often put in segregated wings or even segregated prisons because they get beaten up, particularly child sex offenders, by other prisoners. So there is a particular problem there with people claiming a trans identity essentially fraudulently. And how do you monitor that? And the entire reason behind the initial system of the idea of a medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria signed off by doctors was that you weeded out people who were doing it for some kind of gain and you kind of had a test for kind of genuineness. And so the Scottish proposals would have removed that test for genuineness. They said it's not, you know, the role of the state to rule on anybody's gender identity. And that sounds superficially really plausible, but then you run into a case like that of Isla Bryson, and it turned out that, surprise, surprise, most people, when you say, do you think that a rapist with a penis should be put into a women's prison, go, that sounds on the surface crazy. Why would you do that? And it just unwound very quickly on kind of contact with public opinion, really. And I don't think, you know, I don't think people feel vindictive against trans prisoners. I don't, you know, the prison state in Australia and Britain and America is a very hard place to be. And I can understand that they do face threats of abuse, particularly sexual abuse. However, that the answer to that is not to then transfer those risks onto a population of hundreds of women instead.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. There's so many different shifts that are happening in the feminist movement, which I feel that for a long time there hadn't been. And so I studied feminism. I was a women's officer at my university, and I studied gender studies in the early 90s. And it was a really exciting time where a lot of the kind of complex philosophical debates that were relevant at the time were sort of happening in that gender space. But I'm seeing it happening again, and it's rising in very interesting pockets. There's also, again, coming out of the UK, a type of reactionary feminism. And some of these voices are, again, on Substack. They do the rounds of the podcast circuits. So Louise Perry is one name. Is it Mary Harrington is another?
Mary Harrington. Yeah, Mary Harrington calls herself a reactionary feminist. Yeah, and they're both of those people are really interesting writers who I suggest people read. You know, I disagree with them on a lot, but I find in both cases the arguments to be provocative and interesting. And you have to, if you disagree with them, you should be able to give a good account of why you disagree with them. So Mary, for example, is against the use of the pill. She thinks that we need to, quote, rewild sex by restoring the sense of sort of jeopardy to it that you might might get pregnant. And again, it's one of those opinions where you're like, well, it's a view. I think if you say that to most women, they will say, actually, no thanks. Thank you, but no thank you. But I can, you know, I can see it arises from her biography. You know, I think she left having kids quite late. I think she maybe would have liked to have more. She feels that maybe we put too much emphasis on career and not enough on family in modern society. And you know, those are all legitimate arguments to kind of make and tend to. And Louise's argument, you know, is essentially that the sexual revolution in the 1960s failed. It delivered a great deal of, you know, consequence-free shagging for men, but it didn't really deliver on women's emotional needs. And again, I think I don't agree with all of her argument. I think that, for example, you know, the rise of divorce rates in some ways reflect the fact that women don't have to stay in abusive or, you know, unpleasant marriages, and which is something that you definitely hear of happening in rates when it was a lot harder to leave somebody. And so that's, you know, that but both of them are identifying some factors that are kind of pushing back on the current consensus. And always, you know, this is what I find interesting as I get older, is that actually there's a sort of balance in the force, right? That sometimes liberalism can overreach, and then sometimes the swing back from that, then conservative overreaches. And you also do need those forces to be in dialogue with each other for people to find the medium and find a kind of area of compromise in which the vast majority of a population feel that they can live. You can't, you know, unless you want to live in kind of the Soviet Union, North Korea, or wherever it might be, you can't entirely wipe out your opponents. You have to hear from them and absorb their critiques and try and work out what, you know, what merit there is in them.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. And I think we used to be able to do that a lot more. But there's so much more siloing of these kinds of extremes. And what I'm witnessing is that the progressive left, let's call it that, are actually, they're unable to or are refusing to listen to some of these voices. And so what's happening is a lot of the bro podcasters in the US are picking up on some of these voices. So I think I saw Louise Perry on Chris Williamson's podcast. And so they can get co-opted into discussions around that can kind of verge on pronatalism, you know. And I've also witnessed some of the conservative columnists in the US citing the work of these feminists in articles that are fairly hysterical in and around the topic of population decline, for instance. So they get co-opted. And so you see these really bizarre Venn diagrams where, you know, and the same thing happened during the pandemic, where you had the wellness kind of yoga mums talking to the same song sheet as weird kind of full-on extremist right-wing Trump supporters. And then they found each other on sort of various Reddit forums, and then they would end up talking to each other on each other's podcasts. It's a really strange kind of, I think, offshoot of all of this and quite worrying, and speaks to our inability to kind of handle these nuances. We just go straight to the extreme polarized ends of an issue. Does this worry you? I mean, it's also particularly interesting because some of these voices, these feminist voices, all seem to be coming out of the UK, but then they find quite a lot of traction in the sort of the conservative realms in the States. I mean, I know you're sort of witnessing all of this. Does it worry you at all?
Yeah, it does, because I think, you know, that there is a lot of funding for right-wing media in the US that is not always that attentive to facts. Often, as you say, promotes quite alarmist narratives about, you know, the decline of Western civilization that often comes with quite unpleasant racial overtones. And just by sheer force of kind of money and kind of echo chamberness, it can kind of suck people into it, and their arguments can end up kind of getting flattened or, as you say, are kind of appropriated. And you're right, you know, I've seen both Louise and Mary speak in, you know, a kind of Christian conservative conference in which there were lots of very mainstream and interesting speakers, but there are also some pretty kooky people on the bill as well. And the bleed across is quite high, I think, when you're talking about fears about, you know, that women aren't embracing their kind of natural mothering potential. You know, that's music to the ears of somebody like Jordan Peterson, who's written in his book, you know, he seems very emotionally moved by the thought of the fact that there are loads of modern women out there who leave, you know, having kids too late, and then, you know, they never get over it and their lives are kind of terrible. And I'm sure that is the story of some people, but I also know lots of people who are absolutely happily childless or child-free. And that was the choice that they made, and they don't ever seem to have regretted it. It's not always a tragic story for women, but that obviously appeals to a certain type of man who kind of wants to keep women in their place and thinks that women's place fundamentally is as a sort of nurturing, supportive role. And they think that feminism has encouraged women to kind of abandon their natural duties and compete with men to be, you know, CEOs and whatever it might be. And I, you know, I think a lot about how my arguments land. But the problem on the left that's a kind of corollary of that is the fact that you get people like me who are, by any measure, extremely squishy centre-left liberals painted in these slightly lurid terms. I've just been writing about, there's an article in New York magazine by Andrea Long Chu, who's a trans activist and a critic, writing about transition for children. And she refers to me as an extremist. And I just have to tell you, like, my views are held by like 90% of people, you know, if you look at all the polling. And I would never try and say that I'm preaching anything kind of wild and exciting and out there and outre. I'm not. I'm actually always trying to look for kind of compromise and conciliation and, you know, the best possible balance between different groups. But if you call me an extremist, you haven't got any words really left at that point for, you know, really fire-breathing people who think that transgender people are kind of an abomination unto God and, you know, they should be wiped out of existence. You need to be really careful with your rhetorical, you know, that you're marking people out of 10 and you don't, like, use up all of your fire and brimstone on, as you say, someone like J.K. Rowling, who, you know, sends some pretty spicy tweets, but in terms of her actual policy prescription that she believes in, it's pretty squarely in the middle of the consensus in both Britain and Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If anybody actually reads beyond the 140 character tweet, she has very sensible stuff to say on all of this. And I think this is something that is up for debate and people are discussing this, is sort of some failures of the left. And I think it's a big discussion, obviously, in the US at the moment, ahead of the elections at the end of the year, where everybody's starting to sort of wonder where the left is at and how they go about arguing and whether they're able to tell good stories and able to sort of, I guess take a reasonable centred population through the journey of these complexities, whereas the right seem to be able to kind of go in there and just own most of the situations. And I think it says a lot when people like you and perhaps we are definitely, I would call myself definitely left of centre, but we pop our heads up and want to actually have a say in these complex topics, but we get shut down by the left, and it's using the language of the far right. So throwing words like TERF and woke. And I've had to have a few of these conversations, Helen, with friends who tend to veer more centre-right. I'm like, and are wanting to keep people like me speaking out and talking about these issues because there's, you know, something sensible about what we're saying. And I'm like, you do not want to say those things. You do not want to actually join that Tucker Carlson kind of chorus, because it means there's really nothing left in the sensible centre. And I'm seeing this play out in particular with how the online community is dealing with what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. You've got sort of extremists at both ends sort of dominating the discourse, and anyone who has something sensible to say, something calm, something is that is more about trying to ensure we don't all lose our shit and go down together in all of this, we're kind of unable to enter the fray because we get accused of being too pro-Palestinian, too pro-Israeli, not saying enough, saying too much. And I'd love to pick up on a column you wrote for The Atlantic. I think it was literally 6 days after October 7. And I think the title of it was How the Left Flunked the Hamas Test. It's an incredibly brave thing to have written. And I think a lot of your points still stand 5 months later. You went straight to ground zero on all of this, on how the left is really struggling with these complex issues. Could you describe what the gist of that article was? And I wouldn't mind drilling down into it a little bit, into how it might be sort of still playing out today.
Yeah, the genesis for that article was the idea that I just saw reactions from across bits of the academic left particularly and some journalists and left-wing activists that said, essentially celebrated October the 7th as an act of kind of armed resistance. And that to me was really shocking because, you know, whatever October the 7th was, it certainly involved a lot of violence against civilian populations. You know, a lot involved people who could in no way be described as combatants. You know, we're talking about young people at a music festival. We're talking about people who, you know, deliberately lived in kibbutzes and they wanted to try and live lives of coexistence. You know, this was not a military action. It was more akin to a terrorist action. And I really wanted to make the point, you know, I have huge amounts of criticisms of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. In fact, there were, before October the 7th, enormous protests against him and what he's trying to do in times of neutering the independence of the judiciary. And this is something actually, you know, that resistance to him was snuffed out by October the 7th. And also huge criticisms of Israel's, you know, tolerance of extreme aggression by settlers in the West Bank. And, you know, and it's really sluggishness in extending more rights to Palestinians. And, you know, and I think that's, that. You know, we can put all those things aside for a moment, you know, in the hours after October the 7th and say this was an outrage and a tragedy. And, it, you know, no other country would be expected to tolerate something like this happening. And particularly the hostage taking made it an ongoing crisis. But I just saw lots of people whose estimation of this conflict had immediately snapped into very familiar terms, and particularly American terms, right? That there is a colonizer and a colonized, and it's very simple. You have Israelis who are settler colonialists, who are white, and then you have people of color who are Palestinians who are oppressed. And that is just an extremely reductive way to look at the situation about what's happened. You know, Jewish people faced enormous persecution in Europe, and lots of them, you know, who I've spoken to say that Israel is more than a country, it's a kind of an idea of refuge. It's an idea that if something goes terribly wrong, then at least there's Israel. And at the same time, you have to talk about the fact that actually Hamas are extremely oppressive to the Palestinian people that they rule over. They haven't allowed democratic elections to be held in Gaza for more than 10 years now. They operate a kind of brutally repressive regime there. And they have a constitution that is explicitly anti-Semitic. So all of those things, I think, you know, can coexist together. It is not a simple story of up and down. It is a story of two people who both have claims to the same land, you know, operating in this very difficult wider context. And, you know, we should just be able to hold all that complexity in our mind at the same time. And I also felt that quite strongly, I felt that Netanyahu was bound to have an extremely aggressive military response to October the 7th. And in order to be able to talk about that with the level of criticism and scepticism that you'd expect, you have to first acknowledge that a wrong has been done to the Jewish people of Israel. You know, and that then gives you the ability to say what Hamas did was wrong, answering that in the way that he has with, I think, fairly indiscriminate killing in Gaza and a very large death toll is also wrong. But if you kind of pick your team early on and you don't acknowledge the both sides have suffered, you know, terribly, then you lose the ability, in my mind, to be able to have any kind of moral standing on this.
As the debate progresses as well. I mean, because it's ebbed and flowed in all kinds of directions where all of us, no matter what your original stance was, whatever side you may have picked, which I think is incredibly dangerous in any scenario, but particularly when it comes to the Middle East, it really means that it's very difficult to move with the increasing and compounding complexity that has happened with this issue over the last 5 months. And so people have sort of dug their heels in and then refused to move. And I see the same happen, Helen, to your point that where the left landed in those initial days after October 7th actually has fed and fueled the issue as the crisis has descended. Because where it's left a lot of, I would say, fairly centred Israeli Jewish people around the world is that they feel very, very abandoned in that those first couple of days. It's like, and they've held on to that pain and that trauma and have themselves been unable to move with the complexity of what has now happened in terms of a very disproportionate response and the, you know, the, I guess, what's been happening in terms of claims of genocide, but also the restriction of food and aid into Gaza. So when we dig our heels in like that, it makes it very difficult to then move with the complexity of it and be able to be of some service.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I don't know if you've read much of Naomi Klein's work around doppelganger politics and that sort of the new book that's come out and some of the work she's done discussing Gaza. Have you followed much of that?
Yeah, I reviewed that book for The Atlantic because I way back in the midst of time, reviewed Naomi Wolf's book Vagina, which was really the kind of harbinger that she'd got, was starting to go down a slightly weird path, you know, in which she had a kind of nervous breakdown and couldn't write the book for 6 months because she went to a party that somebody was serving vagina-shaped pasta alongside phallic sausages, which she found to be quite violent. Anyway, I digress. But yeah, I think Naomi Klein's part of a left-wing tradition of kind of quite anti-Zionist Jewish tradition, which has always been a big strain in an American Jewish thought. I think I'd be really interested to see what the polling has done in terms of what October the 7th has done to Jewish American attitudes to Israel. Because I'm sure for some people it has made them feel that they want to kind of completely reject what's going on. And in fact, you saw Jonathan Glazer, who's a British Jew, saying at the Oscars, you know, we refute the Holocaust and our Jewishness being used as an excuse for what's happening in Gaza. But I think there are other people who are quite shocked, and I know this because some of them wrote to me after I published that piece, saying we hadn't quite realised the depth to which people think, to some extent, you know, Israelis and maybe Jews more broadly have kind of got it coming. That you are, you know, you are oppressors, and therefore there is some kind of idea that, you know, that people having an uprising against you can be morally justified. And I think certainly if you were on, you know, some Jewish students on college campuses really, really felt that in the days after October the 7th, that they were surprised that, you know, the feeling of, I think, American Jewry was very much that, you know, thank God we've got to the, you know, we got out, we escaped, you know, we're safe here. And that sort of sense of safety has been ebbed away a bit. Franklin Foer just wrote a brilliant cover story for The Atlantic saying, you know, the golden age of American Jews is ending. And I think there has been a real sadness of feeling you're being asked to choose now, and you kind of, your identities are quite hard to reconcile with each other. And as you say, the bigger problem on the internet is people want to know what team you're on. And I kind of feel like I should go back and write an article that is explicitly critical of Israel's invasion of Gaza, just so that people know that I'm not pro-Israeli. No, any more than I'm, you know, pro-Palestinian. What I am is a journalist writing about the things I see in front of me. But, you know, in all honesty, it's very difficult when you don't have a particularly distinctive take on something to justify, you know, why I, a non-Middle East expert, would write a piece on it. But you know what I mean? I'm sure you must feel the same thing, right? That you feel a pressure to speak to sort of, even if you don't really have anything to contribute to the discourse, you almost being, people want you to sort of pin the flag to your profile so that they know where you stand.
Oh, 100%. And I'm seeing, well, I was a journalist, I suppose. Well, it's like being a Catholic, really. Once a journalist, always a journalist. But I, you know, I am somebody who speaks out on things, not for the sake of, you know, having being in the fray, but more because I feel, and I think you're a little bit the same, Helen, I've heard you speak to this effect a little, particularly around this of the trans debate. I feel almost a responsibility to go into a place of complexity where the far right and the far left are having a massive spat, and there really is a massive vacuum for the bulk of people needing a voice that might actually be representing something that's quite reasonable and sensible and can actually hold at least a bunch of the complexities all at once, and maybe, you know, steers things to a calm place where people can have better discussions. So particularly with this issue, I sat back for a bit just wanting to observe and learn, but I've had all kinds of pushback from pro-Israeli camps, from pro-Palestinian camps that, you know, I'm too this, I'm too that. But I think the really interesting phenomenon that I'm seeing emerging is this kind of overwhelming movement that seems to be gathering momentum from people who have been speaking out in the pro-Palestinian camp in particular, basically calling out celebrities, influencers, I don't know, mummy bloggers, whoever it is, for not saying enough, which seems to be a real perversion of what really needs to be going on here. Are you feeling the same pressure, and what do you make of it?
I think that's really a function of social media, isn't it? It's turned everybody into their own little press release service, and people feel that they have to issue a press release on their feelings about everything. And, you know, for me, the last couple of years have been about not writing as much, not, you know, spaffing out opinions, but actually trying to sit back and learn a bit more and only offer my opinions when I think that they are genuinely well thought out and researched and reported. And in all honesty, it's just about recruitment to a team, isn't it? I don't really see that if you're a, you know, not to be rude, but like a working actor or an influencer or a mummy blogger, whoever it is, you should really be expected to do a kind of graduate level degree in the history of Middle Eastern studies, which is kind of what you need in order to have a kind of interesting, provocative but nuanced take on all this stuff. I think it's kind of fine just to say, I would prefer there to be less violence in the world, and I'm in favour of whatever leads to that outcome. But also, I think, you know, if you are going to have an opinion, you should really try and have one that is relevant to your country, in the sense that if you're an American, then actually the really interesting question is about the pressure that the Biden administration is putting on Netanyahu, you know, as the US is the biggest supplier of weapons to Israel and aid in all its various forms. And, you know, that has, I think, happened, and it's had some effects in the sense that the US was talking about breaking the blockade, you know, bringing ships in with aid. And I don't think that would necessarily have happened without the pressure that's been brought to bear on from the left.
And I do think that there's something to be said there. I think there's an argument that legacy media has tended to be quite pro-Israel, and there's a reasonable amount of evidence out there that the Israeli lobby has quite a bit of influence in mainstream media. And so I think a lot of people are feeling that they've got to give voice to, you know, a particularly voiceless part of the world, you know, Palestine, through social media and sort of sharing what's happening over there, because they feel that there's, you know, something of a conspiracy happening in mainstream media. And I think there's some truth to that. And I think your point is right. Like, I think the Biden administration actually moving on this is in response to what's happening with people protesting and writing stuff at this grassroots level. And ditto in Australia. There has been some movement in terms of calling for a ceasefire and that kind of thing. But at all times, we do need to be mindful of, are we actually helping the process? And if we're having internal spats that are taking up our time and distracting us from things that we could be doing, then that doesn't serve anyone.
Yes, I think people get very tense when you talk about the Israel lobby, because it's often used in these very sloppy ways, in the way that the word Zionist is, you know, was a kind of code word for Jewish, and it's used a lot in conspiracy discourse. But it is very fair to say that if, as a journalist, for example, you want to go and visit Israel, then there are companies that will, you know, and the Israeli government affiliated companies that will kind of enable that to happen for you. You know, they will go and host you and they will make sure that you go over there. You know, it has always been much harder to get into Gaza. It's now basically impossible as an outsider. So there is an asymmetry there in the fact that there are, you know, that there are journalists who have, you know, often in mainstream news organizations, but being in the Jerusalem bureau was always a pretty great gig. So there are just lots more journalists who have an idea about what Israel's like and an insight into the Israeli way of thinking, and they don't have that same on the ground experience from having been to Gaza, or sometimes even to the West Bank. And so when I went over in 2018, and part of that was going to Ramallah as well and making sure that I saw both sides of the conflict. And I think that there is an asymmetry there. And it's definitely, I think, been brought up by lots of people that they feel that, you know, that America, particularly as a military ally of Israel, is automatically more sympathetic to that side. And they want to be representatives of the kind of marginalized voice. And that's not an entirely illegitimate thing to do. So you have to weigh that against the fact that there are also some, as you say, pretty far leftists who are kind of in that sort of, what's the word that Tom Wolfe uses? Like the radical chic, right? That they think that Hamas are kind of quite cool and sexy. And you're like, I really need to break it to you that Hamas would not like you if you are a pansexual living in Brooklyn, right? These are not your guys. And you know, they are a pretty violent, theocratic, homophobic, anti-Semitic regime. And yeah, they're advocating for a cause that is a just one, which is the plight of the Palestinian people. But that doesn't mean that they themselves are just.
Yeah. And I think you can be absolutely pro the Palestinian cause and absolutely 100% against what Hamas is doing. But you can equally be non-anti-Semitic and anti-Semitic and really sympathetic to what is happening around the world outside of the Middle East for Jewish people. And you can voice up against the IDF and the Netanyahu government. I think another aspect to all of this, Helen, is that Palestinian people are unable to leave Palestine and go and do morning television programs in the UK or in the US. And their representatives are unable to come out and actually talk about their plight and discuss some of the nuances, and haven't been able to for a long time. And so, and then their journalists have been targeted. And so a lot of them are not able to get the word out. So there are so many complexities. And I think that what is going on there is almost representative. It's almost like a microcosm of what's happening in the rest of the world. It's surfacing so much of our inability to deal with the complexities that are happening everywhere and are intersecting and piling on each other. And I think it's sort of almost, yeah, it's kind of ground zero for all of this. And what I despair about most is the fact that at this time in history, we do need really good left voices who can speak up for the Palestinian people, but do it in a way that doesn't alienate people, that can actually get the message across in a productive way. And it's just killing me how, you know, people perhaps like you are being silenced. I'm certainly feeling silenced. I feel that every time I come out and speak with some kind of nuance, I'm shut down by everybody. I'm omni-cancelled. You know, it's and we're not the people that you want to silence at the moment, because we probably are able to talk about these complexities, because that's been our job for the last 30 years. And I'm the same. I write on Substack about this, and I write 3,000 word pieces on it rather than, you know, sort of 100 word hot takes with an image of a suffering child on my Instagram feed. But people aren't wanting to read those. People aren't wanting to go into the complexity of it, which I think is, that says a lot about where we're at.
Well, it comes from an impulse that I totally understand, right? Which is that the world is absolutely overwhelming. And you can't study every possible thing. It'd be like studying for the worst exam ever, right? That you have to just have a fully drilled down from first principles opinion on everything. And I so think there is a desperate desire for things to be simple, particularly if you're a kind of casual news consumer, or you're young and you're full of revolutionary fervour. You know, you really have. I think as you get older, you sometimes get a bit jaded and you assume that nothing ever really changes, which is obviously not true. You know, the way that we live now is not the way that we lived in 1890 in any number of ways. But I think when you're young and you're impatient, then, and you know, you kind of want, when you want to be a strong advocate for a cause, complexity is your enemy. You know, you want simple slogans and simple solutions. And, you know, it's the job that we do to kind of just be the one that people look to, because they're tired of just seeing people scream at each other across a divide. And you say, you know, people don't want it, but people do want it. People listen to your podcast, they read your Substack. And I get an enormous amount of mail from people who are just like, I am so relieved. Thank you. Like, honestly, sometimes it's sort of like, thank you for everything that you do. And you go, well, I'm not. Journalists in other countries are getting murdered, you know, and I'm getting some sort of mildly dirty looks. I think it's, you know, I think it's not the biggest sacrifice ever. But I think it's all about the fact that social media has just basically rewarded picking one side and then very strongly attaching yourself to it. And there is absolutely no upside whatsoever in doing, you know, a tweet that says something like, October the 7th was an outrage, but the invasion of Gaza has been an overreaction that has backfired, you know, and has had enormous collateral damage. Because nobody's going to be happy with that. You know, one side is going to be upset you haven't called it a genocide, and the other side is going to be unhappy that you're minimising the suffering of the hostages. And so people don't do it. Why would they do it?
Yeah. And I think for anyone listening who is feeling despairing, when you go onto Instagram or Twitter and you're only seeing these outraged positions and you're wondering if anybody is being moderate and sensible and able to hold these complexities and have better discussions, the thing is that those kinds of people are not on Instagram and not on Twitter saying these things, because it just doesn't work. So I think there's got to be some comfort in that. We've got to remember that the world isn't quite as mad as we think it is. It's just that all the madnesses are playing out online.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the percentage of mad people in the world has changed materially in the last 25 years. It's just that now you hear from every single one of them all the time.
Yeah. Well, the mad people used to be able to have these bizarre opinions, but they could only really share it over the back fence or down at the pub. You know, I think I wrote this in Substack the other day, you know, to about 7.5 people. And they generally get shut down because it is actually a sort of primal reaction to not want to listen to people that kind of polarize and make things uncomfortable, you know. But the way that things work online, because it's at a suitable distance, you know, we don't actually have to see the person, we can actually latch on to just the outrage and off we go, and it serves all kind of cognitive biases.
But the other thing that you were talking about earlier, which I think is really true, is the fact, you know, like the crunchy mums who become anti-vaxxers, who then end up in alliance with the Trump people, who are also anti-vaxxers. And then, you know, one thing I think I really felt like when I made The New Gurus, which was my last BBC podcast series, was that people had got sucked into these kind of conspiracy swamps. And everything is sort of blended together into these kind of vast totalizing narratives. And people had just ended up, you know, whatever their entry point was, they'd ended up buying it all. You know, and so it's not a surprise to me that somebody like Brett Weinstein, who was one of the kind of original intellectual dark web members, who was fired from his post at Evergreen University, or pushed out of Evergreen University for objecting to a day when white people were told to stay away from campus. So he started off as a counselee on kind of, you know, progressive racial politics grounds. He then, during the pandemic, became very interested in ivermectin, which is the deworming treatment, and you know, and sort of thought there was a kind of conspiracy to stop people from being told that this was a much better treatment than the vaccines. And then now he's had, you know, out having opinions about how October the 7th was a false flag. And, you know, he's also veered into various other kind of things. And people don't just stay in one lane. You know, they can now come up with this. Once you sort of decide that everything's being withheld from you, you can work absolutely everything into, embroider that all into your big giant narrative of, you know, they're not telling us everything. And I think the internet's really helped that as well. I'm not sure that flat earthers, you know, crossed over with other conspiracy groups in quite the same way 25 years ago.
No, because they didn't meet each other.
Right,
they weren't
exactly
able to sort of cross-pollinate. Yeah. And you raise that with the whole turf space. Parker Posey, who came out to Australia.
So Posey Parker.
Listening to this in a, Oh, God, sorry. Parker.
No, I do that too.
Which is actually not her real name. It's her moniker. But she came out to Australia and it was quite controversial at the time because I think a bunch of neo-Nazis kind of, you know, joined her big kind of community sessions where they all yelled at the trans issue. But you, I think, have looked deeply into this. You actually found that, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, she was writing on some kind of mummy blog somewhere about, you know, the wonders of giving dolls to boys and trucks to girls and encouraging all of that kind of, you know, diversity kind of thing. So people can actually go from being really outspoken on a particular issue and then just completely switch camps. But the common thing is their outrage. And I think you followed this a fair bit in that podcast series, The New Gurus, that happens quite often.
Yeah, I think that people think that they have politics and often I think they have psychology. And I don't exempt myself from that, right? Like my self-conception of myself is, look at me, wise Solomon, sitting, you know, like calmly considering all the evidence. And that attracts me to a particular set of political positions. And I think the similar thing happens, which Naomi Klein traces very well in relation to Naomi Wolf. You know, she talks about the conspiracist turn and she outlines it being a bit about narcissism, which is the number one predictor for belief in conspiracy theories, because it's like, I'm at the center of the universe. I'm the only one who can see the truth. They're all trying to shut me down. And the one thing it does is it makes you the kind of protagonist of reality. And then she talks about a kind of midlife crisis, which you often see in conspiracist turns as well. Like somebody's just, you know, done pretty well in their career, but then there comes a moment when they realize, you know, one day it's all going to be over and they're going to die. And they kind of can't quite cope with that. And then some kind of personal injury or trauma or embarrassment or humiliation is also something that you really commonly see. You know, whether that is sexual trauma, Lara Logan, who was a mainstream political reporter and is now a conspiracist, you know, she was very badly sexually assaulted while covering the Arab Spring. And I think you have to see part of her kind of turn to anti-immigration politics, perhaps as being influenced by that. And I would say that trauma is one of the most underrated by the general population traumas that you can experience, because people say, oh, you've been cancelled, ha ha ha. But what, you know, the ancient Greeks had ostracism as a punishment. It was something that, you know, that to some extent, you know, death was preferable because you were being cast out. And as humans, we just have this intrinsic need for kind of connection and society. You know, solitary confinement is a punishment. And so cancellation is often sometimes the trauma that takes somebody who might have been a bit difficult or weird or odd and had some slightly strange opinions, and it spirals them out into being a full-blown kook on a, you know, mission to take down everybody who's wronged them.
Yeah. And I think the former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy wrote a book about this during the COVID pandemic, about the whole phenomenon of our need for a tribe, particularly during a time of crisis. So we will actually join a tribal community, like a conspiracy kind of group on Facebook, and we will prioritize belonging and sort of pressing likes, you know, when somebody posts something inflammatory. We will prioritize visibly kind of supporting the tribe over, you know, correct information. We'll know that the information's not correct and it's kind of probably a bit dodgy and problematic, but we will visibly demonstrate that we support the tribe. And that's just what we do. And as the various crises around the world dial up, we tend to get even more tribal. The more complex the world becomes, and to your point, we're overwhelmed. And of course, we're going to seek out simplicity. And the more extreme ends of thought tend to make things very, very simple. You know, Trump being a case in point. And so I think we're just going to see more and more of this. And I think it's so important to talk about why it's happening and to have compassion for each other as we try to navigate all of this stuff, because I think that's going to give us the best chance of being able to maybe seek out more nuanced thinking, because it's a way of sticking a finger up to these kind of forces that are going to take us down eventually. I've got, I guess, a broad question before I wrap up with a final question. How do you explain all of this to somebody who's not online? I don't know, to your uncle at Christmas who goes, Helen, what do you think of what is happening in the world today? I mean, how do you even begin to explain some of this really bizarre stuff to, I don't know, your dad, your uncle, anyone who's not in this space?
I mean, people are quite receptive to the idea that the internet has made everyone crazy. So that's the sort of general explanation, right? I think one of the things, I've just been working on a series that's coming out in the BBC in April, which is called Helen Lewis Has Left the Chat, which is about the role of group chats and instant messengers and private social media, as I think of them. And the thing that's consistently come out of that is, you know, COVID was a really difficult time for a lot of people. They weren't in the real world anymore, you know, everything was happening through a screen, whether that was a computer screen or their phone screen. And people were lonely and they were scared. And that's when a lot of really grim internet stuff happened, right? And I think there is an explanation of a lot of this stuff, which is the communities that form on the internet are fundamentally different to real world communities. They work in different ways. They are much more likely to be self-selected for people, you know, with a particular interest. Whereas in an offline community, if it's like, you know, the running group that you go to or whatever, you're going to much more likely have a real kind of mix of people. Some people you don't get on with, some people different political viewpoints, whatever it might be. You can smoosh yourself into just only a kind of echo chamber and, you know, of people who agree with you on 99% of things on the internet. And that has some really obvious effects. So I think, a lot of it I would explain as being about properties of the internet and what they do to sort of mob dynamics and communities. But also, so a lot of it is just human nature. And that, you know, when I was writing Difficult Women, which is my history of feminism, I just kept being like, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this again. Because you just find out that people had all these arguments in the 1970s and you're like, oh my God, we're doing it again. And, you know, I think it's really useful when you're looking at the kind of debates about healthcare to look at previous times that there have been treatments that people have been absolutely sure were incredible and brilliant and life-saving, and they ministered with the best of intentions. And 10 years later, that picture looks really, really different. You know, that has happened before. And I think when you calibrate your brain a bit like that about, the best way I find to explain new situations to people is to find the right analogy for them, you know, find the personal example that they will understand. And sometimes that goes really badly wrong, right? Because we always try and work out, you know, we process new information through our previous experiences. And so, you know, this is like the expression of kind of fighting the last war. You know, because of those of us who lived through the Iraq War, I think we'll be much more skeptical about Western military intervention anywhere ever again. Whereas if you lived through the lack of intervention in the 1990s and the Rwandan genocide, you might think the actual moral horror there is letting things happen and not intervening. And so you have to kind of make sure that you've got enough situations in your kind of memory bank that you can compare what has happened that is new to them and work out what is actually the best analogy, where does it fit, and not make sure you're just not falling into kind of reflexive thought patterns. But, you know, arguments about what a woman is have been going on for a really long time. What women should do, you know, where they fit, how much ambition is too much, are women naturally better at mothering? Those kind of debates have been going on through written history. I'm sure they'll never go away. And so it's quite useful to be able to talk. And the other thing about talking about, when I try and talk about things in historical terms, is it takes the heat out of it, right? Because no one, you know, you and I don't have a stake in the you and I don't have a stake in the suffragette versus suffragist question, right? Which is about the use of violence in political protests. It's not like I'm attacking your identity or your tribe by doing that. We can talk through about whether and what sense, you know, violence is useful in political protests or can be justified in political protests in a completely neutral way that is both a kind of moral question and a question of its tactics by abstracting it and putting it in a different wrapper. So that's what I often do when I'm trying to explain things to people offline. I try and compare it just to a situation that they will be familiar with, and I try and put it in a wrapper that takes the immediate freighted emotion out of it.
That's really good advice. And I think it is worth remembering that we've had these conversations, these very important conversations, you know, all throughout history. It's just that we're having to see it in our face, the polarized worst versions of it, because we're also very online. But if we can bear that in mind, it does make it less painful. I really do want to know what you're finding out about online or sort of, you know, group chat conversations. Is there a phenomenon there that you can tell us about that we can get excited about and then listen to your podcast when it comes out in coming months?
I mean, I think the thing that's really fascinating to me that's different is about the kind of casualness of them and the smooshing of different parts of your life together. So the analogy I have for that is the fact that, I don't know about you, but I wear formal clothes a lot less than I did at the start of my career. And that's within the same career of journalism. You know, when I went to work in 2005, I was wearing a very nice fitted dress from, you know, LK Bennett or whatever, and some shiny patent leather court shoes. And now what I wear is, you know, white trainers and a floaty dress, right? Like, it's just everything has kind of gone down. And I think lots of people, not just in journalism, but lots of other occupations, particularly with working from home, you know, people don't dress as formally as they did. And I think the similar thing has happened with communication. You know, the fact that you can now text like lol to your boss, it's not something I would really foreseen 20 years ago. So I think the culture has become less formal, and that's been wonderful in some ways. I'm sure lots of people have really experienced that as a liberation. But for people who aren't as adept at navigating social codes, you've taken away quite a lot of the handholds that told people how to behave. You know, the fact when you used to write a job application letter and there was a very hard format and it said, "Dear Sir or Madam," and it ended, "Yours faithfully," those were things that kind of anybody could just learn. You know, obviously it was unequal in that some people, you know, learned them at their posh private school and some people had to learn them, but there was a set of codes. And now we've ended up with things are much more fluid. And I think some people do really find that difficult to navigate. And we end up in these horrible situations where people just don't read the room. And that's really
And you're
tough.
Seeing this, you know, coming up in what's in group chats, you're seeing this kind of phenomenon presenting problems.
Yeah, and all things like Slack at work, you know. Some people are very good at sensing what the mood is, and some people will just talk too much or will say slightly inappropriate things. And if they were in a real life group, they would get instant feedback of the fact that no one was laughing at the joke, or actually everybody looked a bit pissed off because they, you know, said something that was crossed the line. And they're not getting that feedback. And if for people who aren't that kind of, don't have that high kind of emotional intelligence, whatever you want to call it, that I think can be really tough, and they do get themselves into scrapes. And, you know, these are just forms of communication that, again, are different to real life. And that there's some good research on WhatsApp about the fact that in lots of groups, one or two people dominate. And they basically, you know, like if you've ever been in a neighborhood WhatsApp, there's usually one or two people who are sort of essentially like little Napoleons, and lots of people who don't really contribute that much. And again, you know, that would become much more obvious, and people might feel some limiting on themselves if that was a real life situation than they don't in a chat.
And it becomes problematic when some of this kind of familiar behaviour that might be deemed problematic behaviour, if it surfaces outside of the internalities of the WhatsApp chat, when they do surface, which is, you know, something that actually happened recently in Australia with a group of Jewish creatives who joined a very large WhatsApp group to discuss what was happening and how they're handling things and so on and so forth. Somebody got into that, and I think some of the names and conversations were released, and, you know, sort of they were doxed, and that then became a huge issue and, you know, front page news. So I think some of those mores and conversations that can happen in these informal spaces, when they surface and they're isolated as a headline, it becomes very problematic.
Oh, totally. And I think we've got to have a level of honesty about the fact that nobody's WhatsApps would probably reflect particularly well on them, or they would particularly enjoy having them, you know, projected onto a big screen in a public square. And either we can say how terrible, you say all these terrible things and you're very rude about people all the time and how beneath you this is, or we can accept that actually there is a difference between the public sphere and the private sphere, and we can ask
context.
People to act in a particular way in public, but we can't entirely, you know, again, to come back to like whether or not we want to live in kind of North Korea, we can't expect people to be on their entirely best behaviour all the time. There has to be a level of forgiveness for that.
Yeah. My final question, and it's really about promoting your wonderful work that's going to be forthcoming, but you've got a new book that you're doing on geniuses, and you did mention it last time we chatted, but can you give a bit of an insight into some stuff you find? I suspect it's going to feature Elon Musk a fair bit and his role in this genius myth, but can you give it a bit of an overview of that, and perhaps, you know, some of the an interesting point that you're drawing on and that you're quite excited about sharing with the rest of us?
Oh, Sarah, you're making me feel bad because I have now a vision of me coming on your podcast in 2026 and you being like, "So Helen, you're still writing your genius book," and I'm like, "Yes,
my latest book, I've been 2 years researching it, so look, I'm exactly the same." It's cringy, isn't it, when somebody comes up to you and goes, "How's the book going? It must be almost done." You're like, "Yeah, no."
No. Funnily enough, no. Not at all. No, mine is now creeping towards its inevitable conclusion. It should be out next year. But you're right, Elon Musk does feature. Because my analysis is basically about the fact that there's no such objective quality as genius. People have tried to, pretend that there is in various eras, and the latest version of which being the idea of a kind of genius level IQ, which really does not stand up to scrutiny, right? Lots of people that we now hail as geniuses had perfectly normal IQs. And actually, you need a certain level of intelligence to be able to become a really high achieving scientist or artist or whatever it might be. You need to be able to get out of bed in the morning and put your trousers on the right way around. But you don't actually need an IQ of 170. So there isn't an objective criteria for genius. So the question then becomes, well, who gets called a genius and why? And I think it's a way of a culture and a society saying what's important and what it valorizes and arguing about that. So if you look at why Elon Musk is called a genius, it's kind of essentially the argument that you need to be able to, you have disruption, that you can't make an omelette without breaking some eggs. And the idea being that, yes, in some ways he seems extremely unreliable and quixotic and, highly strung, sensitive to criticism, but that all of that is worth it because what he's giving us is in return is Tesla and SpaceX and for people who like what he's done to Twitter. And, that's just not how a previous age would have thought about genius. The Rantics were very attached to the idea of kind of poets with tuberculosis or whatever it might be. Shakespeare is kind of the great because of what he did to the English language, created all of these words and became the kind of national poet. And so you have to kind of ask in every time, what is it that's, beyond the achievement? Because lots of very, very high achieving people are not described as geniuses, Who are the people who essentially get a myth made around them? And what is that myth and what does it do?
I suppose it's what a genius says about a culture, isn't it? Intrigued to hear from you. What does Elon Musk say? If he's the vision of genius in 2024, what's he say about the culture right now?
Well, I think it says there's an enormous anxiety in the West about gender and race, because the subjects in, there is a kind of feeling that STEM subjects, science, tech, engineering, maths, are the real genius subjects now, right? They're the hard, proper subjects. And all of those are dominated by men. And one of the consistent things, I guess, is my overlap with this with difficult women is that, genius is really coded very heavily male. And so what we now get is a sense that, physicists and coders and engineers are the real geniuses of today. They're the ones who are going to, take us to Mars, and they're men. And I think that's something that definitely comes out from the kind of Elon Musk story. And also the other thing that comes out is this idea of being extremely hardcore. This idea that the other thing you have to do to be a genius is just work all the time. And you're essentially a kind of human machine, a human computer. And that, has this interesting adjunct, which I'm not sure how much I'll go into. But Elon Musk has talked about his sense that he's on the autism spectrum. And this idea that genius now comes with a sort of side order of not being a people person, that you are, again, you have this very logical, analytical brain. And that means that you have one set of qualities that are incredible. And the kind of cost of that is that you're, you might be awkward or weird in company. That, again, is not the conception of geniuses that, that a previous age had. Right. And it just seems so natural now.
Yeah. The implications of that, in terms of being, sort of a bit spectrumy, is that you then can, it does give some license to not really being connected to humanity and some of those soft skills, which of course shuts out a lot of women, as does overwork and just being a complete workaholic. Because if women have to go home and look after children, it makes it very difficult to be one of these genius, obsessees who just all they do, as per Elon, he likes to tell us all about how he sleeps on the floor and just gets up and starts working at 5 a.m. and his staff come and see him in there. That mythology is very prevalent. But I think the implications of this sort of spectrumy kind of dude who's just all about his work, it means we've got to almost forgive them for being assholes at times and narcissists. Yeah. I caught your recent article, your profile of Kara Swisher, and it's a bit of a review of her latest book. But yeah, and that sort of tension between her and Elon and the sort of the fallout of their romance. But you describe her as sort of a mum, she's got this kind of maternal role with the tech bros, but a mum who really realises her sons have all turned into assholes. There is a bit of a moment, I think, that's happening at the moment where we're seeing all of this, and it's a very hard thing to kind of navigate. Like, how did we land, you know, at a time in history when we valorise someone like who's basically an asshole, and when we've got so many people also forgiving someone like Trump for a whole range of sins which were just untenable only a couple of years ago, but they're now seen as sort of part of his bodacious ability to kind of just keep moving forward. It's almost seen as a badge of honour, you know, anything that the left tries to peg onto him. He gets away with it, and that's seen as a good thing.
Oh, getting away with it is absolutely the key to genius, and that's what that label kind of does, which is where it overlaps with my Guru series, right? In the sense that some of these people are a replacement for God, in the sense that they are... The point of being a genius is that you're not human, essentially, right? In whatever way that means, you're a special sort of person, and therefore all your opinions are more interesting than other people's opinions. You are, you know, you are loftier than them in whatever way it might be. But the other half of that is the fact that because you are like a mini god, you don't have to be held to the same rules as normal people. And I think the trick comes when you realise that it's not, oh, what, like, what's this accident? Why is it that so many people we call geniuses are assholes? You have to remember that actually that's integral to why, if you're a nice guy who just, you know, if you're Tim Cook at Apple, right? He runs an incredibly, unbelievably rich company. He runs an incredibly difficult supply chain. But we don't think of people who are logistical managers who are essentially quite dull as being geniuses, right? That's just not what we revere in this culture. What we revere is the kind of showman and the person who, you know, has a kind of Stockholm syndrome in people around them. And actually that, you know, the arsehole-ishness then feeds back into it, because the idea will be, why would people put up with this unless we're all on this incredible sense of mission? And it actually, it becomes this feeling that, you know, the people have kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, and people want, you know, there's a kind of, the thing that fascinates me is that people want to sort of sacrifice themselves for a genius. You know, there's, you know, they might be very unhappy doing it, but in a way, in the same way that religion does, it gives their life a kind of meaning that is bigger than themselves. They're part of some grander project. And even though that might be unpleasant, it is kind of fulfilling and satisfying in some grander way.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm looking forward to that book. And so to that end...
Well, you can see now why it's taken me so, like, so long to write. It is just basically, what does all of culture think about all of success and achievement through human history? I don't know why I started writing it.
Yeah. I wish I could write to narrow topics myself. My father tends to look at what I'm writing about. He goes, right, so it's another book of everything. And I'm like, yep. Pretty much.
Yeah, how to do everything. Yeah.
Oh, I know. We could make lives that easier for ourselves and do a sort of a, you know, 15 stoic hacks for succeeding in ice bath management or something. But nope. Hey, to that end, I'm going to let you go, because I'd like you to finish that book and stop doing so many podcasts and just other distracting things. But I really am appreciative of this conversation, really just to make sense of things. And thank you for your work at being that school teacher on the playground, sifting through the spats that are happening, because it's important work. And I think there's a lot of people listening who are grateful for these kinds of conversations, because I think it's where most people are sitting at. It's just that they don't have the opportunity to hear about it and speak it themselves. So go forth, Helen Lewis.
Yeah, well, thank you for you too, because you've created a space, and as you say, you've created a nice corner of the internet where people who want a bit more space for reflection and, you know, thinking about what they're going to do with their one wild and precious life, which is hopefully not scream at people on the internet.
This
you
is
know,
the
that
choice
those
we
people
have.
Can prosper. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you. Well, we'll stay in touch. I will be keeping an eye out for everything you do, and I'll put links to the various articles, my favourite articles that you've written for The Atlantic, a link to your wonderful Substack, which has lots and lots of bizarre happenings showcased in a sort of a weekly list that you put together, and also that Blocked and Reported episode, which I have listened to twice because it is just delightful listening to you and Katie riff. It's wonderful. Yeah.
And I'm doing another episode soon, so I think that's coming out, yeah, quite
yeah, they
soon.
Do love
so
you. They do love you. I'm surprised they get all your gags, because your gags are very British, but they roll with them.
Yeah, I can't help that. I've lent into them. I am now officially like a professional British person. You've got to accept it. And I promise I will come back on your podcast in 2026 when I'm still writing the book.
Wonderful. Let's do the full circle. All right, mate. We'll speak again soon.
Bye.
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 Okay, that was a lot. And bravo to all of you who've made it to the end of this episode, this wrap-up bit that I tend to do. I think it should, however, be a lot, as in we should be taking time to meander around these topics, to get messy and to do a few loops that seem to go nowhere for a bit, and bring in anecdotes and historical references for context, and bring in context when and if necessary, and never in bad faith. And then after lots of back and forth, perhaps arriving at a place of compassion and relief. Because as Helen and I say, the world has always been complex, and there've always been people who've said outrageous spleen-poking stuff, who hate read and hate listen. And there've always been people who do feel obligated to hold the line and to insist on discerning longer form commentary that doesn't play into clickbaiting algorithms. After I finished recording this episode, a friend rang me somewhat in despair about the state of the world and sort of feeling into many of the issues that I think many of us are facing at the moment. And I reminded her of everything that Helen and I had just discussed, and that discerning voices often choose not to be on social media. And if they are there, their measured posts don't tend to get traction, so it's unlikely that she's seen them. And this is the same with the majority of most people out there. Most people are discerning. Most people are capable of nuance and capable of knowing that the world is complicated and that people make mistakes, and one thing can be true, you know, regardless of context or perhaps because of context, and another related thing can also be true at the same time. And true things can morph and shift over time, as can our opinions. It's interesting, I've gravitated to, I guess, a very online world of people talking about these very online issues. And it's referred to, I think, as I mentioned before, a heterodox kind of community. That's a community that questions and goes against orthodoxy. So they're podcasts like Blocked and Reported and Decoding the Gurus, where these kinds of issues are discussed with some distance and with some humour. But I don't always agree with heterodox takes and arguments, and I feel that sometimes they can go too far to the right and actually can play into the right's tactic of turning the left on itself with all their discombobulating anti-woke and anti-turf diatribe. But I do think that sort of talking and listening to these kinds of issues helps me frame things. And oddly, it's provided something of an island of sanity in the world, as Meg Wheatley refers to it. At a bare minimum, it's comforting to hear that other people also get omni-cancelled out there, and often for just being quite balanced and not at all hysterical. Anyone grappling with online noise and hate, I guess what I want to say is that I think it's important to get deliberate around understanding what's going on and around choosing these islands of sanity where longer form discerning debates are going on that allow for disagreement, that are allowing for more challenging views that you may or may not agree with, and that role model hard conversations that allow you to form your own, always adjusting and shifting opinions. I actually think it's a responsibility that we do this. Many of you are already part of my Substack community. It's now about 53,000 subscribers, where we have these kinds of conversations every week, and which spawns questions that become the theme for the Ask Me Anything episodes that run here on a Friday. So you're all welcome to join that community, and you can go to sarahwilson.substack.com to join, and I'll put the link in the show notes if that makes it easier for you. To coincide with this episode, I think I'll do a Substack post where I'll post some of these different heterodox spaces, voices, podcasts, Substack sites, where you might be able to, I don't know, find your island of sanity amongst it all. As always, please do stay wild and discerning.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.